Do you like words? Do you? Do you like words? I bet you've never really thought about it. I kind of consider myself to be a wordsmith. I love words. I like to write. I like to edit. I like to proofread. I kind of feel like I have a pretty good-sized vocabulary. So Kay and I were talking about this week, and she actually said that she feels like she has a larger vocabulary than me. And we sort of debated that back and forth until I was reminded in 40 years of marriage, I've never beaten her in Scrabble. I've never beaten her. And so we don't even play Scrabble anymore. It's just too painful. I like to learn new words as well. That got me into trouble a while back, actually several years ago. I saw a t-shirt at a store, and it had a word screen printed across the chest that was just a cool looking word. It had the punctuation sort of things on it, and it just seemed like, if I had that shirt, nobody would know what it meant. I'd be the only person who knew what it meant, and it would just be so cool. So I bought the shirt, $20, and took it home. This was before smartphones, and so I couldn't look up the meaning of the word in the store. So I got it home, and I looked it up, and I knew right then I was never going to be able to wear that shirt. I showed it to my wife, Kay, and she agreed, "You're never wearing that shirt." And so it was a $20 rag that went to the rag bag. And I like to add new words to my vocabulary. This week, the word that I added was modalities. Modalities. So I said to the staff in staff meeting, all the department leaders here at Centerville, I said, "We've got to be willing to explore new ministry modalities." And nobody looked at me funny or strange, like they didn't understand what that meant. And I didn't know what was going on. There's no way they all understood what modalities means. But maybe they do. So I love words. And so this week, as I was studying Mark chapter 14, and if you have your Bible or your device, you can go ahead and turn there. Mark chapter 14, a word came to my mind. And this is the word that came to my mind. The word visceral. 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 And what that word means is deep, sort of gut-level feelings or emotions, instinctive feelings that are intense. And so maybe just let me give you a few examples of what I mean by that. Around the Clark household, it's been an eventful few weeks, with emotions. My oldest son, Ryan, sold his business, and so he got out from under a role that sometimes was crushing in its stress and its responsibilities. And so he had a visceral relief. My son, Jeff, sold his house, and he'd been planning to do that for a long time, thinking about it and figuring it out. And finally, on Friday, he was able to sign the papers. He had a visceral thankfulness. He was so thankful to be able to get through that process and the way things had all worked out. My youngest son, Kevin, and his wife, Rachel, had a second baby boy, another grandson for Kay and I, on Monday. And so he and Rachel had a visceral joy. And then my wife, Kay, on Friday, she said goodbye to her job. She was leading a not-for-profit organization here in Dayton, and she began a sabbatical season in her life. And she had a visceral gratitude. And so we're talking about deep, intense emotions. And so, again, in Mark chapter 14, this is a chapter that is filled with emotions, visceral emotions. This is what we're going to see as we go to that chapter. The Pharisees had a visceral hatred for Jesus. Jesus had a visceral sorrow over what's called the cup of his sufferings, a visceral sorrow. Judas had a visceral regret over his betrayal of Jesus. And then lastly, Peter had a visceral grief over his denial of Jesus. And so let's start with the Pharisees. The Pharisees. In Mark chapter 14, in verse 1 and 2, it says this. It was now 2 days before the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and the chief priests and the scribes were seeking how to arrest him, Jesus, how to arrest him by stealth, and kill him. For they said, not during the feast, lest there be an uproar from the people. The Pharisees had a visceral hatred toward Jesus. And I wonder, why? How did that happen? Why were the Jewish leaders willing to plot to murder him, to kill him? And so I began to think about how that must have developed over time, how their interactions got worse and worse. And I saw that in Matthew chapter 23, there is this incredible confrontation between Jesus and the Jewish leaders. I mean, it's been boiling for a long time, and it's perked up for now and then, but I mean, it becomes shock and awe, this confrontation between Jesus and the Pharisees and the scribes. And so this is the last public message that Jesus is going to give before his death, and he ends up using it to denounce the Jewish leaders. What he does is he pronounces seven woes against the Pharisees and the scribes. And so let's think about, what is a woe? A woe is a cry for God's just judgment in light of an action that deserves a divine response. And so what that's saying is that Jesus was crying out for God's justice in light of what the Pharisees and the scribes had been doing. So in Matthew chapter 23, let me just read a couple of these to you. It's incredible. It says, "But woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites." Six times Jesus calls the Pharisees and the scribes hypocrites. "For you shut the kingdom of heaven in people's faces, for you neither enter yourselves nor allow those who would enter to go in. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you travel across sea and land to make a single proselyte, and when he becomes a proselyte, you make him twice as much a child of hell as you yourselves." Woe is right. He shreds the scribes and the Pharisees. And so let me just summarize some of the other things that Jesus says about them. He says that they're hypocrites, obviously, six times. What he's saying, that what they do never matches up to what they say. He says that they only want to be seen by men. The scribes and Pharisees are all about being seen. They're all about externals, managing and massaging their image before the people. He says that they are blind fools, that multitudes of people are following them in their corrupt ways. He says they're full of greed and self-indulgence, that they prefer the best seats, the best titles, the best of everything because of their own sense of self-importance. They're blind guides straining out a gnat and swallowing a camel, that they're focused on the minutiae of the law, and yet they ignore its greater demands on their lives. And he calls them serpents, a brood of snakes, of vipers, that just as Eve was deceived in the Garden of Eden by the snake, the people are being deceived by these Pharisees and scribes. And then lastly, he says that they are whitewashed tombs, clean on the outside, but corrupt and dead on the inside. That is an amazing confrontation. I mean, of course, the Pharisees and the scribes, they grow to hate Jesus because he calls them out. He speaks truth to their power. And so they sought an opportunity to arrest him and to kill him. Cold, calculated hatred, visceral. They're threatened by Jesus, and so they figure out a way. How do we get rid of this guy before he ends up getting rid of us? How do we do it quietly without making a scene? And lo and behold, the solution to their problem drops right into their laps. In Mark chapter 14, verses 10 and 11, "Then Judas Iscariot, who was one of the 12, went to the chief priests in order to betray him to them. And when they heard it, they were glad, and they promised to give him money." You know, it's interesting. The Greek word there for glad can also be translated thrilled. the Pharisees and scribes were thrilled that they had this opportunity to kill Jesus. I mean, let that sink in for a moment. The spiritual and religious leaders of the day, the leaders of the Jews, were thrilled that they had the opportunity to take out, to murder one of their critics. I mean, that is just so messed up. Well, how did they get this far? How did they get so far off course? You know, something that I thought about this week is, you know, the Pharisees had an unquestionable belief in their own rightness. An unquestionable belief in their own rightness. See, they believed that God had called them, He had appointed them to be the soul keepers, the soul interpreters, and the soul dispensers of divine truth. They believed that they were infallible. Infallible. And I don't have to tell you that that kind of a character flaw is deadly in the life of really any person, but in particular, a leader. And so the Pharisees, they have no remorse of any kind, no recognition of their own visceral hatred and the pathway that that is leading them down. So that's the Pharisees. Well, what about Judas? Let's talk about Judas for a few minutes. We all know the story of Judas, that he betrayed Jesus, and then afterward, Judas was filled with a visceral regret. A visceral regret. Why did Judas betray Jesus? Let me give you just a few things to think about. First is the love of money. Judas loved money, and we'll see that in a couple of passages that we look at in just a few moments. Secondly, greed. Judas was greedy. He was the keeper of the money bag, and he wanted more money. He stole from the money that was there, and he was just greedy for more. And then discontent. Judas was discontent. He saw what was happening with Jesus, and he was just convinced that Jesus was going to screw this thing up. He was discontent. He was arrogant. He said, I'm going to take the reins, and I'm going to determine the outcome of this. He was arrogant. And then lastly, disillusionment. Disillusionment. I don't think that Judas ever really understood who Jesus was and what Jesus was about, what his mission was about, what he came to do. And so reading in Mark 14, beginning of verse 3, it says, and while he was at Bethany in the house of Simon the leper, as he was reclining at table, a woman came with an alabaster flask of ointment of pure nard. Pure nard. You know, I got to tell you, when I read that word pure nard, I think to myself, I don't want anybody pouring pure nard on my head. I mean, that just doesn't even sound good. But I did a little bit of research about nard, and that's really short for spikenard, which in fact is still available today. You can get it as an essential oil. And they say that it's earthy, you know, it's earthy in its smell, its tone. And even a little tiny vial of that spikenard can cost $50. So it's very costly. And she broke the flask and poured it over his head. There were some who said to themselves, in particular Judas, indignantly, why was this ointment wasted like that? For this ointment, we could have gotten 300 denarii. It could have been sold to be given to the poor. And they scolded her. But there's a little bit more to understand about Judas and his perspective that we don't find in Mark. We actually find it in John chapter 12. Judas Iscariot complained about the value of the ointment being lost, not because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief. Having charge of the money bag, he used to help himself to what was put into it. Judas, he was greedy. He loved money. He was discontent. He was arrogant, and he was disillusioned. All of that adds up to betrayal, to betrayal. In Matthew 26, we read this in verse 14. Then one of the 12, whose name was Judas Iscariot, went to the chief priests and said, what will you give me, see the lover of money, "What will you give me if I deliver him over to you?" And they paid him 30 pieces of silver, and from that moment, he sought the opportunity to betray Jesus. And so we said that we know the story, we've heard it so many times, Judas sells Jesus out. I mean, he provides exactly what the Pharisees are hoping for, a way to quietly snatch Jesus up in the dark of night and avoid any kind of a ruckus, just to get rid of him. You know, it's interesting in John, the writer, the apostle John, says that Judas is a son of perdition. He calls him a son of perdition. That word perdition is interesting. It can mean utter destruction. He's saying Judas is a son of utter destruction. It can also mean damnation and ruin. And so he's saying that Judas is the son of damnation and ruin. I mean, that's incredible that you would be seen that way. Have you ever wondered if Judas could have repented? If he could have confessed what he had done and been forgiven? I mean, I wrestle through that, and I know there are issues of election and foreknowledge and all of those kinds of things, but I just wonder, could he have repented? And so this week, I found a book called The Words and Works of Jesus. It's a classic written by Dwight Pentecost. And listen to what he says about this very thing. He says, it's very significant that at the Last Supper, Jesus gave the first dipped piece of bread to Judas Iscariot. It was customary to offer the first piece of bread to the most honored guest at the feast. John 13:26 tells us that person was Judas. Judas was seated just to the left of Jesus, a position of honor. Jesus already knew what was in Judas's heart, and yet he offers Judas that very first piece of bread as a picture of the love and grace that's offered to all of us through Jesus, even to you and to me. Jesus was symbolically offering to Judas a chance to turn it around, to choose a different path, and to offer him the forgiveness that comes through the bread of life. In that moment, Judas could have chosen a different path, but it didn't happen that way. In that moment, Satan entered Judas' heart, and Judas arose to earn his blood money. That makes sense to me. That would just make sense. That feels like God, what God would do. But yet it wasn't to happen. And so early the next morning, Judas saw that Jesus was being handed over to Pilate. He could see where this thing was going. Jesus was going to die, and Judas was the cause. Judas made it happen. In Matthew 27, it says this in verse 3. But when Judas, his betrayer, saw that Jesus was condemned, he changed his mind, regret, and brought back the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and elders, saying, I have sinned by betraying innocent blood. And they said, what is that to us? See to it yourself. And so Judas threw down the 30 pieces of silver into the temple and departed, and he went and hanged himself. And he went and hanged himself. A visceral regret. What a tragic figure that Judas's regret didn't lead him to confession. It didn't lead him to offer to God a broken and a contrite spirit, or to cry out to God for a clean heart like King David did after he had betrayed Uriah. Judas's regret led him to self-destruction, to death. One commentator that I was reading said this, Judas lives on the stage of Scripture as a terrible warning to the uncommitted follower of Jesus, who knows about Jesus, even from up close, but who has never given his heart, his will, his life to Jesus. The modern-day Judas would be one who frequents the church, is up close to God's people and the work of the church, but has never become part of the church. The called-out ones who have come out from among the masses to accept the call of Jesus to follow him. Judas leaves the gospel story a ruined and doomed man because that's what he chose. And God confirmed him in that terrible choice. A visceral regret that led Judas to self-destruction. And so let's just pause for a second. Are you with me? Are you still with me? I mean, I know that this is not, you know, the light and cheery message that you would hope to hear, perhaps. But this chapter, Mark chapter 14, is not light and cheery. And so even in the midst of sorrow, there's something for us to learn. So let's talk about something maybe more positive, at least in the way it turns out, the outcome. Let's talk about Peter. Peter had a visceral grief over his denial of Jesus. I mean, after Peter realized that he had done just exactly what Jesus said he was going to do, I mean, this big, strong, strapping fisherman, he broke down. He broke down in waves of tears. But Peter's denial of Jesus was just the final blow. The first blow had landed hours before. The Last Supper, the Garden of Gethsemane, the trials of Jesus, all of that had happened in a single night from sundown to early the next morning. And what happened to Peter in that time was brutal. It was brutal. Jesus had completely deconstructed this overly confident disciple. And Peter's sense of self was a pile of tattered rags. And so let's review what Peter had gone through over the last hours. It began, number one, it began with boasting at dinner that he would never fall away, never be scattered. And so in Mark chapter 14, it says in verse 27, "And Jesus said to them, 'You will all fall away, for it is written, I will strike the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered. But after I am raised up, I will go before you to Galilee.' Peter said to him, 'Even though they all fall away, I will not.' And Jesus said to him, 'Truly I tell you, this very night, before the rooster crows twice, you will deny me three times.'" And so that is the first body blow to Peter. And the second, refusing to allow Jesus to wash his feet at the supper. It's from John chapter 13. We read this in verse 9. "Jesus laid aside his outer garments and taking a towel, tied it around his waist. Then he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel that was wrapped around him. He came to Simon Peter, who said to him, 'Lord, do you wash my feet?' Jesus answered him, 'What I am doing, you do not understand. You don't understand it now, but afterward you will understand.' Peter said to him, 'You shall never wash my feet.' And Jesus answered him, 'If I do not wash you, you have no share with me.' Simon Peter said to him, 'Lord, not only my feet, but my hands, my head.'" And so that was the second body blow to Peter, as he refused to allow Jesus to wash his feet. Thirdly, repeatedly falling asleep when Jesus had asked him to be in prayer in the Garden of Gethsemane. We find this in Mark chapter 14. In verse 38, it says, "Simon," this is Jesus speaking, "Simon, are you asleep? Could you not watch 1 hour? Watch and pray that you may not enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak." This was a trifecta. This was the third time that Peter had fallen asleep when Jesus had asked him to pray. That was the third body blow. Number four, drawing his sword and cutting off the ear of a high priest's servant. It's in Matthew chapter 27, beginning in verse 51. In Gethsemane, with confronted by Judas, and the soldiers, it says this, "And behold, one of those who were with Jesus," and John 18 indicates that that's Peter, One of those who were with Jesus stretched out his hand and drew his sword and struck the servant of the high priest and cut off his ear. Jesus, he turned to him. He said, "Put your sword back in its place, for all who take the sword will perish by the sword. Do you think that I cannot appeal to my Father and he will at once send me more than 12 legions of angels? But how then should the scriptures be fulfilled that it must be so?" I mean, Peter is failing at every turn. Body blow number 4. And then lastly, perhaps the tipping point, denying 3 times any connection to Jesus. It says in Mark chapter 14, beginning at verse 66, "And as Peter was below in the courtyard, one of the servant girls of the high priest came, and seeing Peter warming himself, she looked at him and said, 'You also were with the Nazarene, Jesus.' But he denied it. 'I don't know what you're talking about. I don't understand what you mean.' And he went out into the gateway, and the rooster crowed for the first time. And the servant girl saw him and began again to say to the bystanders, 'That man is one of them.' But again he denied it. And after a little while, the bystanders again said to Peter, 'Certainly you are one of them, for you are a Galilean.' But he began to invoke a curse on himself and to swear, 'I do not know the man of whom you speak.' And immediately he heard the rooster crow for a second time. And he remembered how Jesus had said to him, 'Before the rooster crows twice, you will deny me 3 times.' And that's when he breaks down and begins to weep. Body blow number 5. He collapsed. He wept. I think perhaps this is the darkest moment in Peter's life. Well, you think about Judas, you think about Peter, and what made them different. I think one of the things is this. In the hours to follow Peter's denial, he gathered himself. And he began to connect his failures to Jesus, to who Jesus was and is, all that Jesus had done and all that he had taught over the 3 years that Peter was with him. I think he probably remembered the supper that was just a few hours ago and how even though evidently Jesus knew exactly what Peter was going to do, that he was going to deny him 3 times, even though Jesus knew that, he was able to take the water and the towel and wash Peter's feet. He remembered that. I think he probably remembered the words that Jesus said as he broke the bread and took the cup. He remembered when Jesus said, "Drink of it, all of you, for this is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins." For the forgiveness of sins. And oh my gosh, how much Peter wanted to be forgiven. I also wonder if the words of Psalm 51 might have come to Peter's mind, a psalm that surely Peter would have known. They're the words that Jesus spoke and prayed during his own season of confession and repentance. It says in Psalm 51, "Have mercy on me, O God, according to your steadfast love. According to your abundant mercy, blot out my transgressions. Wash me thoroughly from my iniquity and cleanse me from my sin. Hide your face from my sins and blot out all my iniquities. Create in me a clean heart, O God, and renew a right spirit within me. Cast me not away from your presence, and take not your Holy Spirit from me. Restore to me the joy of my salvation, of your salvation, and uphold me with a willing spirit." I think maybe Peter thought about that psalm. Maybe not the exact words, but the same sense of brokenness and contrition. Peter's grief became hope. Peter's grief was turned toward hope, toward a new beginning. He turned toward Jesus and a new beginning. And afterwards, Jesus, you remember, He invites the disciples, and he specifically mentions Peter. He invites them to come to Galilee where they can meet with the resurrected Lord. Jesus began graciously, lovingly, to restore Peter's relationship with him. Peter had a new beginning. And so the last character that I want to look at today in Mark chapter 14 is, of course, Jesus. Jesus. As Jesus prayed in the garden, the enormity of the next few hours weighed so heavy upon him. Jesus had a visceral sorrow over all that was coming next, over the cup of suffering that he would have to drink from. You know, just a side note before we take a look at those passages. You know, one of the buzzwords that gets talked a lot about today is authenticity. In particular, millennials and those following millennials talk about they want to be with people who are authentic. They want to be led by people who are authentic, people who are honest and transparent and vulnerable about who they are. And it's said that if you're going to lead millennials, you'll never find success without authenticity. I just was thinking about that in this context. Jesus was an authentic leader. He was the most authentic leader I've ever seen. I mean, he is honest about who he is. He's not fake or pretentious. He's vulnerable. As he prayed in the garden, I mean, he just laid it all out for everybody. He was so authentic. Mark chapter 14, beginning in verse 32. And they went to a place called Gethsemane. And he said to his disciples, "Sit here while I pray." And he took with him Peter and James and John and began to be greatly distressed and troubled. And he said to them, "My soul is very sorrowful, even to death. Remain here and watch." And going a little farther, he fell on the ground and he prayed that if it were possible, the hour might pass from him. And he said, "Abba, Father, all things are possible with you. Remove this cup from me, yet not what I will, but what you will." And he prayed that same way three times. Distressed, troubled, very sorrowful, even to death. You see, in my opinion, that is the most human you will ever see Jesus. He's praying to the Father out of the depth of his humanity. Is it possible that there's another way? Is it possible? You know, theologians and scholars have had a pretty lively debate over the decades and even centuries about what Jesus really meant that the hour might pass from him and that God, the Father, would remove this cup from him. I mean, was he asking to avoid the cross? Was he asking that he could avoid the weight of the sins of the world from resting on his own shoulders? Was he asking to avoid the spiritual separation that he would experience from the Father for the very first time? And we can't really be sure. It's just a debate. But we do know that Jesus, his sorrow was overwhelming. It was visceral. And yet his sorrow didn't derail him, and it didn't ruin him. Jesus' sorrow turned into resolve. He resolved to give himself to the Father's will, knowing that God's will is always the best outcome. Yet not what I will, but what you will. And so Jesus was able to resolve, to push through, to trust the Father. He resolved to see the joy that was set before him, to endure the cross, to scorn its shame, and to sit down at the right hand of the throne of God. He resolved. His sorrow became resolve. He had the long view of what God was going to accomplish through him. And so, do you see what I saw as I studied this week? The Pharisees and Judas and Peter and Jesus. Just gut level emotions, visceral emotions.